out of that either the roles or missions, the roles and missions study, that there had been 80 proposals or 64 proposals, and all but 8 of them were accepted. And those that weren't accepted were the ones that dealt with special branch taking over the anti-infrastructure role as its primary and sole as the organization that would have the sole responsibility for the anti-infrastructure operations, which suggests to me that that MACV had that responsibility, or at least shared it with special branch prior to then. Okay.
That I think clears that question up in terms of how it could be answered. There wasn't really any particular emphasis on infrastructure, other than in the CIA itself.
Okay.
And so that, but when the issue was raised, I would reconstruct from what you just said, the Pentagon paper said, that MACV opposed an exclusive jurisdiction for the National Police, with which we would have agreed. I don't. I participated in the roles and mission study, but we would not have claimed for the special branch exclusive jurisdiction. We didn't want it. The special branch wasn't strong enough. National Police weren't strong enough. What we did claim that the police should have the major civilian role, so to speak, be the spearhead of the effort, because it was the police that, over the long haul, and in terms of an ultimate victory, it was the police that would have to have settled the problem. And so, now in terms of the MACV opposition to special branch, it more properly should be said that until late 1966, that MACV really wasn't aware of special branch. They didn't know anything about it.
Okay.
And they were not aware of the intelligence potential or the intelligence capability of the police by and large.
Okay.
There were individual exceptions to this general rule, generalization.
Okay.
The general pattern of military operations, for example, if the military were going to go into a province, that of course was cleared with the ARVN and components and all that jazz. But the sector advisor and the sector S2, in other words, the military province, senior officer and his intelligence guy, would be brought in by the U.S. military. And that was the end of it. And the military would go in and do their thing, and come out. And they were not aware of the enormous capability residing in the special police.
Okay.
So a big part of our problem throughout this whole effort was promoting the National Police, and in particular the special branch, as the counterinsurgency arm of the civilian government.
Okay.
And so this resulted in my briefing. I spent an hour with Westmoreland once. This resulted in my many visits with General McChristian out into the provinces. And so on. It was bringing an awareness. And as a matter of fact, we finally did write into the ISAC's charter the necessity for full coordination at province level of the military, for example, with National Police as well as with these other people. And bringing the National Police in as supporting adjuncts to the military sweep or county fair.
Fair
type operation.
And that's when that starts, is 66 then, those are the first joint operations between the military and the special branch?
I wouldn't say they're the first. I mean, bear in mind the U.S. military was only in there from mid-65 on.
That's right. So it's only been there for a year.
It took a period of time for some of these things to develop.
Right. Okay.
All I can say is that, to my knowledge, that the exploitation of province national police resources by the U.S. military was sporadic at best, up until the time we made a systematic procedure out of it.
And that's when eventually, at the top, you and McChristian get together and
agree that process is going on.
Okay.
Because some of these military officers are very bright, and they saw that there was something there, so that you could go into a certain province, and the military would be the national police would have been brought into the whole thing by the military from stage one.
So in a sense,
but this was ad hoc. This was not something which was a policy or a program or anything which was organized.
It's just intelligent people seeing the way assessing the situation on their own and realizing that, despite any institutional bias between the military working with the police, that had to be overcome in order to deal successfully with the insurgency.
There was unquestionably contempt held by Arvin for the National Police. The Vietnamese military had no use for the National Police. That's a true statement.
Okay. I've heard that before.
To the extent that U.S. military may have reflected Arvin. For example, if there were an Arvin American joint operation, well, then the National Police, the province police, would have been systematically cut out of the thing by Arvin.
Okay. In a sense, then, American advisors are the ones who bring these two organizations together.
Yes.
It's the cooperation of American advisors that ultimately brings Arvin and the police together.
And the whole ISAC/Phoenix thing was an effort to institutionalize.
I think that conceptually, that's the biggest point.
Yeah.
Of the whole thing. Okay.
Yeah. But at the higher levels, for example, Westmoreland, I don't think he ever heard of the Special Police Corps before our briefing.
Okay.
Or of the fact that we had province interrogation centers, or the fact we had a political order of battle files, lists of VC in villages and hamlets and in province and so on. And Westmoreland, I don't think he had a dream about that.
Yeah.
Comer was right, and the other people were right, at the common observation, that the Americans went in there to fight a classical land war, and that just isn't what it was.
There was a thousand battlefields.
Now, many American officers, I say officers, up to division generals, commanders, and so on, fairly quickly adapted. Others didn't. Some military minds... Mines brought in these 20 or 30 or 40 ton tanks and this and that and the next thing, which were for which there was relatively little use.
And they got bogged down in the deltas.
In terms of American military and the opposition to special branch, that would be the exclusive responsibility that they would be opposed to. Primary responsibility, I'm not sure that they would. Object because they weren't interested. They didn't understand the VCI, the infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't necessarily interested in it. They were looking for main forces to fix, engage, and destroy.
Okay, very good.
And so that it was a matter of ignorance and a matter of more than anything else.
And would the same
now, when the time came. Of course, the question of civilian versus military dominance of what's going on was a chronic problem throughout.
Yeah.
And this came up, of course, in the Phoenix organization, and it can be seen in the operation of the Phoenix program afterwards, that the military in no way were going to submit themselves, American or Arvin, were going to submit themselves to a civilian direction.
Okay.
Conversely, any time that the military took over an operation or an activity, nine times out of ten, it would be a perversion of the civilian capabilities into a military support arm, by which I mean we saw many cases where the military became predominant in the operation of province intelligence, for example. And we would almost invariably, not always, but almost invariably find that the so-called civilian intelligence operation was quickly perverted to provide tactical combat intelligence for U.S. forces or for armed forces. And this was a tendency which had to be constantly opposed. Now that tendency was just as strong under ISAC/Phoenix mm-hmm. as it was before ISAC/Phoenix. Okay. And it's something upon which the civilians were fighting this constant battle to maintain the integrity of the counter-subversive operation, if you will, mm-hmm. because the military didn't seem to understand it. They felt they were fighting a purely military war, which they were not.
Mm-hmm.
And in consequence, even in Ralph Johnson's book, as a matter of fact, some of the quotes as we go down through here, they point out this as a problem.
Okay.
Now this became, and I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself, but I'm going to be racing because there's, I think, a lot to cover.
Well, you why don't you cover the points that are that well, you consider yeah. ones to be most significant?
Well, let me finish up on this point. This became the issue between Bob Wall and myself in Three Corps.
Okay.
I've now reconstructed the history of what happened with Bob Wall and the dioxin.
That would be fantastic.
I'll give that to you in a few words.
Good.
Bob Wall was first assigned as deputy in I Corps. And it was in that capacity that he was instrumental in creating the DIOCs, the District Intelligence Operations Coordination Centers.
Okay,
Luigi Canin okay. had been appointed Roik in Three Corps. Well, now, Luigi was just out, I mean, this is a fish out of water.
Mm-hmm.
And when he had this big drunk one night and dropped flower pots on people down the street down
the Duck Hotel,
that
yeah.
was at the Duck Hotel. That was the end of Luigi.
Yeah, and then he got sent to Fuelba or whatever it was.
Yeah, whatever.
Okay.
But Luigi, I mean, he was a great guy and all that, but he at this stage of the game he was supernumerary, he was drinking buddy, and that's about it.
Okay.
Luigi is not an institutional or an organizational man, period.
Right. Okay.
And he did not fit as a Roy. That also period. And he was unhappy. In mm-hmm. any event, after a number of months, and I don't know how many, 3 to 5, Luigi had to be relieved of his assignment because this Duck Hotel incident was only the latest of a number.
Okay.
And so Luigi was reassigned, and Bob Wall was brought down from I Corps
okay.
as Roik in Three Corps. Now, that was shortly before I left country, and I had very little to concern myself with that situation.
Okay.
It was when I came back TDY with Ev Parker in the fall of 1967 that it became evident that Bob Wall was permitting the military people in Three Corps to basically turn the entire intelligence operation and everything else into a military support adjunct.
Okay.
Ignoring the infrastructure, basically. Even though Bob Wall was pushing the DIOCs like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the upshot was I recommended a disciplinary action against Wall and or relief from duty. And Ev Parker, of course, was in charge of it, and he didn't do that. Ev Parker has a Chinese mind, and he, as I was talking about the other
yes.
day, he chose to deal with Bob Wall problem in a different way, and I think probably successfully.
Okay.
I would usually to
soften Wall's position.
Yeah.
Okay.
I would rock a boat and sometimes sink it. Ev Parker would perhaps steer it in a different direction so that it didn't take the same
okay.
waves.
I like the imagery. Very good.
Yeah.
Okay.
So now then. Going to Ralph's dissertation here.
Okay.
There are several things that I find where he has missed the boat, and okay. I think and things that I would recommend to you in this in your paper, your book.
Very good.
Ralph really does not talk about the special branch.
Not at all. I don't know if it's ever even mentioned.
But, oh, no, no, it's mentioned many times.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, police special branch is mentioned many times. And you and I have talked about it before. And this is the unit of the National Police that the CIA was working with and supporting.
Mm-hmm.
And I would suggest for your book that you go into a little bit of descriptive detail as to what the special branch was and how it evolved.
I've been asking everybody that question.
And how it was organized and so forth and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Min, that you were talking to the other day, what was his name?
Dang Van Min.
He probably
began in the Sûreté, and then was one of those people who made the switch over from when it was called the Sûreté and was based on a French system, to the influence comes from Malaysia, Sir Robert Thompson. Special branch, and they changed the name from whatever their equivalent, I think it was the Kong, something or other, to special branch.
Okay.
I don't know what year that happens.
Well, that should have been. Robert Thompson came out as consultant to the Vietnamese government, I think in 1961.
Okay. So I would assume that it would be about that time.
I would think so, or shortly
the
after.
The title would be changed.
Now, the special branch should not be compared with the FBI in this country.
Yeah, okay.
It does have to be looked at within the European police context.
Mm-hmm.
It is most comparable with an intelligence division of a modern major city police force.
Okay.
And then, bearing in mind that it is a national police, they do have national, regional, province, and district police offices, and there's a vertical hierarchy there, mm-hmm. vertical chain of command. Same way with the special branch. Each one of these levels would have a special branch operation.
Okay.
These are the people that would be have the counter-subversive mission.
Right.
It's not comparable with the FBI. It's not comparable with MI5. Mm-hmm. It's not comparable with the Sûreté. It's the British special branch of the police.
Right. Okay.
Now, as I say, that it should be described, its missions and functions, how it works, to the extent that you're able to develop that information. Dang Van Min probably gave you a lot of information.
He did, yes, he was free.
In all cases, of course, this was what is told you. It was probably the ideal version of the way it ought to be rather than the way it really was.
Mm-hmm.
Because the special branch suffered from incompetent leadership, it suffered from
Dang Van Min said to me is that the head of the special branch was always a political appointee, whose primary responsibility was to make sure that the National Police got his payoffs and his money, and that Dang Van Min, was the guy, the only institutional person whose primary job was the perpetuation and survival of the special branch itself, apart from political considerations.
And apart from the CIA. The CIA would have blown the country wide open if they had tried to abolish the special branch or anything like that.
Okay. But that's Min's representation is accurate.
But regardless of what Min said and what I just said, the fact remains that the special branch personnel and the special branch leadership were a cut above the regular staffing and the regular leadership of the National Police per se.
Yes, okay.
Okay. A second thing that Ralph did not do, and which I'm sure that you will do, is to give a much better and a systematic discussion of the various CIA programs.
And you're including these census grievance, revolutionary development, PRU, PIC, all that.
Yeah. First of all would be the FI programs, foreign intelligence programs.
Included under that would be?
Of which I was a part.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be the specifically the informant program, the PIC program, and the penetrations.
Yeah, and that we've discussed in
some detail.
Right.
And that's all you got. If you talk to Sam Draculich and if you talk to Dick Akins, well, I don't know whether you have or not.
Well, I talked to Draculich, but he rambled on about other subjects.
Well, unfortunately, Draculich hates my guts.
He didn't. He spoke about you with respect.
I'm surprised.
He did. Everybody who's... The three people that I've mentioned you to have all spoken about you with respect and high regard.
That's nice. Good.
Okay. I've been surprised at a lot of professionalism.
Yeah, well, Draculich himself was... we had to relieve him of duty.
He's a little...
Yeah, he's a little wacky. He was in too.
He didn't make much sense when we were talking.
That's right. Yeah, okay. And but he was one of the first guys in the country at the beginning of the build-up. A little bit longer than that. Mm-hmm. I lived with him for 3 months when I first arrived there. He was a little bit flaky at the time.
I think
he got more so. He refused to live in Benoit, and he was the Region 3 officer in charge.
Did he live in Saigon?
He lived in Saigon. It was over that issue. I wanted him to live, as I wanted all of the regional officers to live in their capitals.
Yeah.
He had a place to live out there. It had not been bombed in 30 years. He was terrified that his house there was going to be bombed. And so he came into Saigon each night. Well, the point came that where he was not supervising the province operations, and he was not resident in place in Benoit, and therefore I persuaded Tucker to relieve him of duty.
Okay.
Tucker and I did this, and Howard Stone had just come into country at that time.
Okay.
And was putting on pressure for VCI penetrations already yet.
Okay.
So what we did, Tucker and I, to respond to Stone on the one hand and to solve the Draculich problem on the other, because Draculich is one of these guys, I've always had a notion, ever since I was a kid, that it's the crazy people that have bright ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've always been willing to play with people like that, or play along with, or to be friendly with them and so on, even though they're ignored by the rest of the kids in school.
Mm-hmm.
The same way with Draculich. He had a lot of good ideas. He had a big mouth. Had a tendency to wander and all that, but still, he might be useful. And so we created a VCI penetration unit, high-level penetration unit,
mm-hmm.
and switched Draculich from Region 3 officer in charge, a Region 3 field officer,
okay.
to run this VCI penetration unit.
Okay.
Now, he was to do exactly what was later taken away from us by Howard Stone.
I see, okay.
And that's to review all the penetration cases that were generated any place in country, go out and interview people, evaluate the cases, and if they looked any good, to set up special arrangements and special priority for those penetration cases.
Would you just repeat that a little bit slower?
Yeah.
Okay.
Starting where?
With the... what the requirements of that group were.
Yeah.
Okay.
The purpose being to review all of the cases of so-called penetration cases.
Nationwide.
Okay. And to visit the provinces to do this also.
Okay.
To go on out to the province and talk to the officers and visit and assess the cases.
Mm-hmm.
Determine whether they probably were good or probably were.
By reading the dossiers?
By reading dossiers, by talking to the officers, by reviewing the communication procedures, in some cases even by meeting the damn fool agent.
Okay.
Whatever. And then come back and we would apply special care to the development and nurturance of that particular case.
I understand. Make sure that person had everything that they needed.
Yeah, communications, proper requirements, full exploitation, so forth and so on.
Okay.
Okay, regardless of the potential importance of this job, and it was a good job we gave to Sam,
yeah.
He could not ever adjust to the fact that he had been relieved of his regional officer job.
Okay.
And therefore he finally left country, and that was the end of that.
And at that point he was replaced by Luigi, himself was replaced.
No.
Okay.
No. Oh no, this was years earlier.
Oh, okay.
This was years, this is before Luigi even came back to country.
Okay.
This would have been about March of 1966 that these events took place. And Sam left in summer of 66.
And that, so then Stone himself shows up a month or two before then.
Well, he's the one who was putting this pressure on penetrations to start with.
Okay.
And but Stone set up a special branch,
mm-hmm.
To take over what Sam Draculich was supposed to be doing.
Okay.
Well, okay. So much for that.
Does that, and then that disappears from special branch?
That disappears from my operation and from our operations over there in the liaison branch completely.
Okay. And becomes a unilateral operation.
Yeah.
Okay.
What it is they came over to us. They did exactly the same thing as Sam Draculich was supposed to do.
Yeah.
except they did it, and then these cases would disappear from our purview.
Okay.
If they were thought to be any good.
Okay, so these
in any event, we have the three programs, the informant program, PICS, and penetrations, and as you've already discovered in talking with Muldoon.
Yes. Who also program, spoke about you with a lot of high regard.
Well, we liked each other. He's a good guy. He really is. Muldoon was in on a PIC program from the beginning. This PIC program started in summer of 65.
Okay.
There were about seven of them built by the time I got there, and then I supervised or was steward or whatever you want to call it for the construction of the about 30 more.
Okay.
I think the total number of PICs built in total were about 37.
Okay.
There were some provinces we couldn't even, the security of the province capital was so bad we couldn't even put a PIC there.
Okay.
Now the reason I make a point of this is the fact that Ralph Johnson has his chronology screwed up.
Okay.
And we'll come to that when we whip through his book very quickly.
Okay.
But the basic idea is that the PIC program had absolutely no relationship whatsoever to Phoenix.
Okay.
You might call it a foundation stone upon which Phoenix, it was later possible to construct an ISEC / Phoenix program.
Okay.
So that you might look at it from the time the U.S. forces went in 65, actually from the earlier than that even, that the CIA was putting in places foundation stones. And it was in for counterinsurgency.
Okay.
And it was only in late 66, 67 with ISACs that we're able to integrate these into a comprehensive counterinsurgency thing.
Yeah.
We never had a counterinsurgency doctrine overall. And probably the closest things that came to that would be the combined campaign plan of 1966.
Okay.
And a predecessor document, the name of which I forget, of 1965. Actually, there was an annual campaign plan was developed. And it is not correct, as Johnson says, or as some of the thrust of some of what I've said is that there was never any effort to coordinate these programs. There was.
Okay.
There was serious effort. Okay, the going back to the programs,
mm-hmm.
we've mentioned the police liaison branch.
Okay.
Then, of course, there's the three that you've already mentioned, RD,
mm-hmm.
Census grievance,
mm-hmm.
and the CTs.
Yeah. Okay.
Might as well call them what they are until
until
their name is changed. These were created, according to Johnson, around 63, 64, these programs.
Okay.
Those programs also should be described. Johnson doesn't describe them.
No, they don't. But
he
you know,
give an inventory of assets.
That's why I interviewed Donovan. That's why I Donnie you, because I'm getting in order to do this story on Phoenix. You have to do the story on every program that it brings together.
I'm
thorough.
And
if I sounded a little tired when I spoke to you on the phone, it's because I was physically tired at that minute.
This is what you're doing is hard work.
Yeah.
I know that.
Sometimes I get a little discouraged because it's like every question I ask, if I get the right answer, raises three more questions. So every time I get the answer that I'm looking for, I just look at more work. So sometimes I get a little
frustrated. It does have to be a cutoff point, too.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. So anyway.
So what can you tell me any more about the creation of the counter-terror teams?
Well, now I can't because that's something that Donahue and those people would
to discuss with Methvin or something.
Basically,
like that.
Yeah, I'll stew Methvin would be one.
Okay.
Basically, they were exactly what the later leftist propaganda described. They were teams to go in and do to the VC in VC-controlled areas exactly what the VC were doing to us all the time.
Kill their village chiefs and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah, it gets sort of interesting, though. You know, up there in I-Corps, there was more than one case where U.S. advisors would be found dead with nails through their head.
Yeah.
The VC in villages, when the VC would come in, They'd leave a couple of heads sticking up on fence posts as they left.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. And so the counter-terror was, frankly, was doing the same kind of stuff.
Documenting cases of all that.
Well, this book that came out, Brennan's War, it's really quite good.
Is that recent?
Well, I don't think it's too recent, but it's a paperback, and it was, it's a first air cav recon team leader.
Okay.
What they call B teams.
Yeah.
And they got to the point where they were collecting ears.
Yeah.
And doing all sorts of strange things. And a guy that would stay in country too long would fall victim to this kind of thing.
That's right.
And this apparently is what happened to Holly North.
Yeah.
He was that kind of guy.
Did you hear through that in the papers?
No, that was in the papers.
It was. Okay.
It was in the papers.
He seems, he has that look in his eye of a guy who had one too many missions at night into enemy territory.
A thousand yard stare.
Yeah, he does have that look.
Yeah, he does.
You know, it's kind of the eyes kind of roll back and it gets that grin on his face. And
okay, new subject.
Okay.
And sort of miscellaneous thought. It's something that has to be touched on.
Okay.
And that is that one of our problems in Vietnam, as it was in Laos, as it was in the Far East generally,
mm-hmm.
is that that part of the world seems to generate the warlord.
Yeah.
The warlord and the warlord psychology. It's just, you just can't get away from it. And this is something that will poison the Americans as well as it would the Vietnamese. So the upshot of this is that in Vietnam in particular, before
mm-hmm.
somebody comes in with a sledgehammer to make and knock heads together.
Yeah.
That you've got, if you've got 44 different provinces, you've got 44 different wars going on.
Okay.
And 44 different warlords. And then on a regional basis, same thing on a higher scale.
Yep.
And especially in terms of the division and corps commanders. These guys were, it's the intoxication of power is what it is.
Yes.
But the American regional officers and the American province officers often would fall victim to this same virus.
Syndrome.
Yeah, the same virus.
Okay.
And Bob Wall was an example, again, of this kind of thing.
Okay.
Before we get to Johnson's book, there's a point that I wanted to mention the other day and somehow or another skipped over it. And that is that throughout the war, right on down to this day, there's a major psychological and policy split. On the Americanization, on the one hand, which can conveniently be summed up in the word slopes as an expression of attitude, versus the nation-building approach, on the other hand, which recognizes that the Americans don't know all the answers.
Okay.
And that we've got to work in a fairly sophisticated basis with a local culture, especially
mm-hmm.
one as highly developed as the Vietnamese, and highly civilized. Or brutal, as the case may be.
Which is more human nature than culture,
well,
I would say.
We'll touch on that when we come to the question of torture, but that's okay.
Okay.
And this is what made the development of a comprehensive counterinsurgency doctrine almost impossible.
Okay.
And this shows up in policy conflict, it shows up in agency conflict, it shows up in individual behavior down at the individual advisor level, up and down. And the CIA has traditionally, and I in particular, put our money on the nation-building approach, a respect for a native culture, so forth and so on. This is the total, and although that putting our bets on that doesn't mean that everybody agreed with it by launching.
Right, okay, within the agency.
Yeah, within the agency. On the other hand, the Americanization approach is the primarily exemplified, but not exclusively, by the U.S. Army.
That's right. Okay.
We'll come in, we'll wipe this thing up very quickly.
Well, our firepower won World War II, can win Vietnam.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a, you could also find this thing in same sort of syndrome in USAID.
Yep, okay.
We're paying the price today with salt infiltrated wells in Africa and that kind of thing. The Americans know best. They know how to they're smarter than anybody else.
Okay.
And they've got better technology than the next thing. They go in a country and they ruin it.
That's right.
And it's been done in Africa, it was done in Asia, it was done in Iran, it was done in Vietnam.
And it comes, I think, basically, having been thinking about it for the last couple of days, that it's a fallacy to think that you can impose cultural values.
And political systems.
And political systems.
And that's often a State Department syndrome. So in terms of an overall counterinsurgency doctrine, I don't think you're going to find this in a library. I'm quite willing to loan it to you.
Thank you.
Put my name in it. But because on pages 5 5 on.
Okay.
Chapter 5, chapter 6, 7, 7 in particular.
Okay.
There is a counterinsurgency doctrine set forth, which is quite rational. And in fact, overall, the United States was doing, and the Vietnamese governments were doing all of these things, but not necessarily very effectively.
Okay.
And not necessarily with any sense of integration, with enormous amounts of waste and so forth and so on. But
can you state that doctrine?
Well, it's
simply.
I would summarize it in terms of major military forces to provide to cope with main force units of the enemy,
mm-hmm.
and to provide a shield behind which nation building, counterinsurgency, and nation building can take place.
Okay.
And this is something which we're talking in terms of decades, not in terms of one or two victories or anything like that. But and this book was studied by quite a few of our people, as were other books.
Okay.
But I admire that.
Yeah. We did discuss that our first go round.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I just hit a few notes here, and then we'll go on to Ralph's book.
Well, were you going to say something about torture?
We'll touch on it when we get into the book.
Okay, because that's something I have not broached with anybody.
Yeah, well, okay.
But I would, it's interesting.
Well, let's see, I have several miscellaneous notes. John Hart, as a person. Somebody described him as a megalomaniac.
Yes.
He had a very high opinion of himself. And I forget what his background was, but he's a tall, 6 foot, lean, athletic officer.
Mm-hmm.
With a sort of a, I think he'd gone to school in England, or at least he has a
schoolboy.
Or New England, as the case may be. Okay. I don't know. He has a prep school accent.
Yeah, okay.
And, a very dry voice and dry sense of humor, to as far as that goes.
Okay.
He is macho.
Mm-hmm.
Very heavy on tennis and that kind of thing. Played it every day. Smart, which I've indicated. Very bright.
Currently writing a book on Napoleonic War and involvement of Russians and France.
Wouldn't be at all surprised. Okay. John Hart is he claims to be Norman in ethnic origin, 400 or 500 years back.
Living in France, incidentally.
Yeah, he's, he spoke French rather fluently,
mm-hmm.
and insisted on letting everybody know that very quickly.
Okay.
And, Red Stent used to say that you can always tell somebody that parades their knowledge of French by the way they use a subjunctive. Well, John Hart can use it properly, and he does, to make sure that you know that he knows.
He can conjugate his verbs.
Yeah, that's right. he had a very soft spot in his makeup someplace for the PM type.
Okay.
I think that John Hart himself may very well have been a frustrated soldier of fortune.
Okay.
Certainly in terms of psychology.
Okay.
And so, ergo, he had a very soft spot in his heart. And that's the reason he gave Luigi
Okay.
And the job he did when he did it. But it was also with other people.
Anything relevant to what's...
Well, what's relevant, I mean, is that the kind of trips we took, that day we took the trip where we had a cocked automatic in us. That was a Belgian something, 9mm. So he was very interested in those people, and he might turn the other way rather than chastise them, whereas somebody else he might shoot them out.
Does Lou Lapham bring a different management style?
Lou is a very very laid back, quiet ex-professor. Tall, thin, thick rimmed glasses, that kind of thing.
Okay.
A very nice guy. Lou did not have a background in military PM law. He did have a background in propaganda, psychological warfare, that kind of thing.
Okay.
Okay. So that I think explains a little bit about John.
Yes. It's like poetry. I never was able to understand a poet's poetry until I understood the poet.
Yeah, I think. Yeah.
And I don't think you can understand policy decisions that are made unless you understand the people who are making those decisions and what motivates them. Mm-hmm. And to get a true historical objective view of why decisions are made, personalities do apply.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, they absolutely. I've always said intelligence is 95% biographics myself. This leads to a new thought where I'm just wandering off on a tangent, which I have, from my early days in the agency, I've described the intelligence service as it plays a socially acceptable way of expressing fundamentally criminal tendencies. That the guy who has strong criminal tendencies but is too much of a coward to be a criminal would wind up in a place like the CIA. If he had the education and the knowledge of history and so forth to go with it. So I put John Hart in that category. Okay. I put him as a mercenary, as a soldier of fortune, who found a socially acceptable way of doing these things and getting very well paid for it at the same time. End of thought, new thought coming up. Bob Comer.
Okay.
Ralph Johnson does him a little bit of a misjustice. He says he's a former Mideast analyst for the CIA. Well, I guess maybe he was. But very quickly, Bob Comer was one of the bright young men.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, when the CIA was reorganized by General Walter Beadle Smith in 1951.
Okay.
And they created the Office of National Estimates.
Okay.
Bob Comer was one of the first to be a member of that office.
Okay.
And it was his visits from that office down to my office in OCI, which he would make from time to time,
mm-hmm.
that I first met him.
Okay.
And he went on, the Office of National Estimates from the beginning was a high-level organization.
Okay.
And he went on to move from one high-level job to another, and I can't tell you what they all were.
It's okay.
But I do know that we got to know each other fairly well back in those old days, and that this was part of what our relationship was later.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Now, in Saigon, Comer did visit there when he was in the White House fairly often before he came out on PCS.
Okay.
And when he did, he would systematically visit different offices, and my office was one of them. And so we would chat, we would give them briefings and so forth and so on. So once again, none of us, John Hart, Comer, Nelson Brickham, any of these other people were strangers when was finally decided for him to come out PCS.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, new subject. New subject, new thought. But I don't want to tell you how to do your business, but whatever you do,
please
start out with constructing a chrono. A chronology of events.
I intend to.
Because this is where Ralph Johnson blew it. Mm-hmm. He did not create a chronology of events, and in so doing, he made a number of serious mistakes.
I'm glad that you had a chance to read this.
I'll point some of those out as we go through. I think rather than going through the rest of these notes now, then we'll go through his book, and take care of all that, and then whatever is left over from here, we'll be able to.
Also, Nelson, I have no intentions of saying goodbye to you today.
Yeah.
And not getting back in touch with you again. Hopefully we can have phone conversations, and while I'm actually doing my writing, I can check back with you.
Well, I'm sure you haven't had a chance to study.